Good morning to everyone. Our first case this morning is number 073545, White Eagle Cooperative against Charles F. Connor. Mr. Bettney.
Thank you, Your Honor. Please, the court. My name is John Bettney. I represent the plaintiffs' appellates in this case. Let me start by placing the case in a framework that is understandable. This case is about integrity. It's about procedural integrity. It's about substantive integrity. This case could be about cars. It could be about pollution. It could be about toys. It happens to be about milk. The backdrop in which the administrative law issues are placed are complicated. The administrative law issues, however, are those that come before this court and other courts very frequently. I represent dairy farmers and the marketing cooperatives of which they're members. Farmers are located primarily in Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan, members of White Eagle Cooperative, Erie Cooperative, Continental. I also represent Family Dairy Co-op, which has members in Michigan and Wisconsin who sell milk in the Mideast. The White Eagle Co-ops have a small share of the Mideast market. That is the raw milk that's sold in the Mideast. The 2005 USDA adjudicatory process hearing that brought us here caused the White Eagle farmers to incur, uniquely, those farmers, to incur greater costs in transportation and marketing to maintain what then became a shrinking share of the Mideast market. The other plaintiffs, Central Equity, National All Jersey, Lanco, market little or no milk in the Mideast. They are parties and come before this court and came before the district court to preserve, or rather to restore, procedural and substantive integrity to the administrative process. And that's what brought us here, integrity. If there is perhaps one word that will describe, in addition to integrity, all of the issues, all of the six issues that are raised, it is standardless. Another word is rudderless. Another word is administrative ad hocery. If there's one word that will, I believe, describe the defendants, the respondents' position in defense of the rule, that word is deference. Which brings us to virtually every issue, and I'd like to start with the substantive rule and the familiar principle of administrative law involving deference. Deference is something granted not at the beginning of a process of review, but at some point after the beginning. The case of Indiana Forest Alliance, which was cited by the USDA, I think lays it out pretty clearly. Deference comes at a point if the agency has considered relevant factors, if the agency has not disregarded factors that are deemed important to Congress, if the agency changes direction and explains and acknowledges and confronts a change in direction. All those ifs, which are a prerequisite to consideration of deference to the factual findings, all of those ifs are missing in every substantive part of this decision. It's missing for the RFA analysis, it's missing for the emergency decision, and importantly for the future of the program, it's missing for the decision of the Secretary, for the first time I'm aware of, in a rule adopted, to move away from a standard based on supply and demand, willingness, ableness, and ability to supply milk as a basis for dairy farmers to share in a revenue pool to one of reasonable reserve. Reasonable reserve is now a new standard, but it is a standardless standard. The decision is full of adjectives and descriptors. And the Secretary apparently believes that use of enough and a varied number of descriptors is sufficient. Those descriptors are something that should be, something that is adequate or inadequate, something that is excessive or inexcessive, something that is appropriate or inappropriate. All of those words are used repeatedly and are used in the final conclusions. And what the Secretary concludes is that there is there's too much milk going into cheese. That's part of this revenue pool. It's excessive, and what we're doing is appropriate. That is very disturbing under common principles of administrative law for several reasons. First of all, the conclusion reached was reached with ostrich-like approach. It did not acknowledge or address the specific standards that have governed USDA's decision-making on this kind of rule for over 30 years. And those standards are basically able, willing, able, and ready. They are supply-demand standards. Starting at least before 1976, but 76 is the most elaborate explanation of that in the Upper Midwest rule. The Secretary said we should accommodate in the diversion provisions of an order milk that is available to meet fluid needs of the market. That corresponds, Your Honor, with the situation in the 1920s and 1930s, where cutthroat competition between producers caused Congress to implement this program in the first place. Those producers that were in competition were outlying farmers whose ordinary market was manufacturing plants, cheese plants, butter, powder plants. In fact, the Alto decision, to which this case is essentially a sequel, Judge Posner described the statutory scheme as giving producers whose milk goes into cheese a share of the revenue pie to keep them in their place so that they would not engage in competitive activity which preceded the act, that is, coming into the city markets, cutting the throat of their fellow producers by offering milk at a discounted price. The orderly marketing that is achieved is one that is dependent upon revenue sharing. Getting back to the standard list. So USDA, in this case, although it was encouraged to during the hearing, it was encouraged to in briefs, it was encouraged to in exceptions, to make a decision in this case which at least acknowledged and then reconciled its decision based on numerous standards that have applied from 1976 or before through 2000. It did not address those.
Can you speak to your challenge to the RFA certification? Because I don't think it's entirely clear what burden is imposed on small entities by the amendment. And, of course, there's case law that seems to suggest that producers are not regulated by this regulation.
Handlers are regulated, Your Honor, if I might answer in that order. The RFA does not use a standard or use the words regulated by as a basis for RFA analysis. It used the words subject to. And subject to is affected by, and in fact USDA has in the past done RFA analysis and did in the year 2000 when this larger scheme of marketing orders was adopted. The Secretary did an analysis involving both producers and handlers. Producers are the intended beneficiaries, as you know, of this program. It is the revenue redistribution part of the program that directly affects producers, that producers are subject to. In a different context, Your Honor, I think that Congress, when adopting the RFA, intended that if there is a substantial impact on a significant number of small entities, that a rule would be analyzed for that impact. The Secretary's argument that producers, the intended beneficiaries of this statute, are not within the scope of folks whose impact has to be analyzed, would in fact make half of the regulatory program and half of the regulations totally immune from any RFA analysis whatsoever, because the program has two parts. One, it has a price regulation imposed upon handlers. Then it has a pooling or revenue redistribution part, which applies to producers. The Secretary would never, ever have to do an RFA analysis on the latter part, nor could any court ever review an RFA analysis on the latter part, because the Supreme Court in Stark versus Wickard says that handlers have no justiciable interest in the distribution of the revenue pool. The money coming to producers in this case flows from handlers, who are given the ministerial duty of distributing money. But the relationship between producers, dairy farmers, and the Secretary of Agriculture is that of trustee and beneficiary. To say that the Department of Agriculture, which serves as the trustee, has no obligation to measure the impact of its rules on the beneficiaries it is intended to serve would seem to be somewhat absurd. And the most recent case of the aeronautical workers from the D.C. Circuit, the D.C. Circuit distinguishing cement kiln, where some indirectly affected parties said, you have to measure the benefit on us. The persons to be drug tested under the aeronautical workers case were not directly regulated. They were subcontractors. But they were subject to, they were affected by. And the court said, that is enough. The magic words are not regulated by, regardless of how much USDA uses them, the magic words are subject to. And in fact, USDA's brief said that the rules in question here govern what a dairy farmer must do to be eligible to receive the revenue benefits. Now, what a dairy farmer must do suggests to me, and I'm persuaded that it does, that certain behavior of dairy farmers is governed. Now, the consequences of failing to meet those standards, unlike handlers, are not an enforcement action. The consequences are economic. Your revenue is reduced or your revenue is eliminated. It is still, however, a consequences of failing to follow or, in fact, following certain rules and obligations imposed. And those rules and obligations imposed upon dairy farmers by USDA have two objectives. One is the objective of bringing all producers for all milk, shipping to all handlers, into a market-wide pool. The word all is used three times, Your Honors, in Section 7 U.S.C. 608C5B. The word all is one of those statutory, if not a mandate, it is a factor that Congress has considered important in structuring these revenue pools. And recall that Motor Vehicles versus State Farm defines arbitrary as follows: an agency decision that fails to consider relevant factors in agency precedent or that somebody brings to the agency and persuades the agency is material, but certainly agency precedent, or which fails to consider a factor that Congress has deemed important. The statutory argument involving all milk to all producers, for milk delivered to all handlers, a uniform price regardless of how it is used, is, if not a mandate, a very important factor that Congress directed USDA to consider. What USDA did in this case, not only did it fail to address the all producers, all milk, to all handlers factors deemed important to Congress, or the ready, willing, and able, if supply and demand required, factors that were established in 25 years of decisions, the Secretary, at the end, decided that some milk and some producers should not be eligible for revenue pooling for the reason that not enough of their milk went to Class 1 use. Now, that certainly seems inconsistent with the mandate in Section 608C5B of a uniform price regardless of use. Now, the government might argue at some point that, well, all of these rules have some limitations. There are some producers that can't participate. There's some in California. California producers are, I think the Secretary reasonably found, not ready, willing, or able. They're not proximate to the market. But this particular rule disqualifies producers in Ohio, in Indiana, in Michigan, because their milk goes to a cheese plant if the handler or cooperative to whom they ship does not have sufficient customer base to a fluid plant. And it's not really about whether there's too much cheese milk, because those same producers, that same farmer who is disqualified by this rule, who's a member of White Eagle, if he can't market in the Mideast as a member of White Eagle, that producer could, under this rule, market to that same cheese plant day after day, month after month, year after year. All he has to do is to decide to become a member of DFA, Dairy Farmers of America, or Michigan Milk Producers, but particularly DFA. They have pooling base to spare. The end result, then, of excessive surplus milk is a bit disingenuous. But the problem with that excessive surplus or excessive reserve is nowhere in this decision does the Secretary provide us any criteria on how that is established. What factors apply to what this new determination of excessive reserve? Secretary drew a line. But the rational connection between facts found and choice made, the Secretary didn't describe how he arrived at that line. He provided adjectives, he provided descriptors, appropriate, inappropriate, should be, shouldn't be. But he didn't provide the factors that got him there. We do not know, and recall, this is an adjudicatory process rulemaking. I must advise my clients. My clients, whether I'm there or not in the future, should know how to govern their behavior, should know how to channel their evidence in the future. They don't know from this decision, first of all, whether any of the factors that have applied in the past will apply in the future. And they don't know how to apply this excessive reserve. If, in fact, excessive reserve is now the new standard, and it's a first-time standard, as I explained in the brief, the only prior time that it was applied was in 2002 out in the Western market when Dairy Farmers of America decided it didn't go far enough in excluding excessive milk, and the program was terminated out there. If that is to be the new standard, the Secretary could, with a stroke of a pen, essentially eviscerate the driving force behind this statute, and that is to embrace producers of surplus milk in part of a revenue pool, allow them to share. The Secretary drew a line. He didn't explain how he got there. If the same line were to be drawn, for example, in the upper Midwest, which includes northern Illinois, Wisconsin, Minnesota, more than half of the milk that is now participating in that revenue pool would be excluded from the revenue pool. And all that would govern that decision is use of the word excessive. or appropriate or inappropriate, because no further standard has been identified in this decision. Same thing is true with the emergency rule that is contested here. That emergency is over. There's a final decision. But, Your Honors, the statutory directive, this time in the APA, is that emergency decisions are made where the situation is imperative and unavoidable. Imperative and unavoidable. In the informal rulemaking equivalent for this, the standard is good cause. And there's a lot more law for good cause than there is for imperative and unavoidable. I suggest the standard is no less than where there is an imperative and unavoidable. One of the decisions made on an emergency basis was something called double dipping. You don't really have to understand what double dipping was to understand this. The double dipping mill from California had not come into the Mideast for 3 years before this decision was made. And there was no suggestion on the record or in the decision that California Milk stood ready to come in soon. If the Secretary's decision in that case, and what this court's decision will do is to guide the Secretary in the future, if something that hasn't happened for 3 years and is not likely to happen in the future, there's no indication in the record that it's likely to happen, probable to happen in the near future. If that meets the definition of imperative and of unavoidable, then as we said in the brief, everything does. All the Secretary has to do is to raise his hand and say this is an emergency. And why would the Secretary do that? Because the dominant cooperatives who propose things request the Secretary.
How many dairy farmers are adversely affected by this?
I beg your pardon?
How many dairy farmers are adversely affected by this rule?
Which rule? All dairy farmers are adversely affected by some parts of this. If we're looking at the substantive rule on diversions, I would say the farmers that produce the 150 million pounds of milk per month that were represented by the White Eagle co-ops, they were the targets of this rule change, and it's those producers numbering a few hundred out of a few thousand in the market.
So 100 out of a few thousand.
Right. So the number there would be on that one rule. The producers affected by emergency process is everybody.
I say adversely. They're all adversely affected?
In this case, no, not everybody. But everybody is adversely affected by a standardless process, which the Secretary asks this court to affirm. Because in the future, somebody else's ox will be gored by standardless emergency proceeding or by standardless substantive decision. I see that the white light is on, and I'm working into my rebuttal time. Let me say that...
Let me just ask you this question. Of course, you acknowledge that diversion limits have existed for some time, and this amendment did not introduce that concept, right? So you agree that there is that it's appropriate to have diversion limits.
To my knowledge, there have always been some diversion limits.
Right.
Yes, and I agree that's appropriate. The question is the standards that govern the adoption of those, which were the historical standards were disregarded and a new one was created without explaining how they got there. Just to conclude, deference, referring back to the Yateman case and the Forest Service case, deference is not license to disregard past policy. Deference is not license to disregard factors. Deference is not license to evade factors that Congress has deemed important. That is what basically each of these issues is about. I know I haven't addressed some of these issues, and I may address them in rebuttal, but I certainly don't intend by not addressing them to waive them. I wanted to respond to the court's questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bentley. We'll hear now from Ms. Chaffetz.
May it please the Court, Samantha Heifetz from the Department of Justice on behalf of Edward Schaefer, the Secretary of Agriculture, and the United States Department of Agriculture. Plaintiff's substantive challenge, Your Honors, really focuses on the 2005 amendments to the Mideast Milk Marketing Order, which revised pooling standards that are used to determine whether certain milk supplies should be considered part of the Mideast Milk Marketing Order. And as Appellant's counsel comments during oral argument have highlighted, the plaintiff's appellants really don't challenge, they make quite clear in their brief, in fact, that they do not challenge the authority of the Secretary of Agriculture and the USDA to set diversion limits. In fact, they acknowledge the need for such standards. The AMAA, the Agricultural Marketing Agreement Act, authorizes the USDA to issue milk marketing orders establishing regional milk pools. And the objective here is to achieve a stable pool with an appropriate supply of milk while fairly distributing the benefits and the burdens of pool participation. Because it's a regional system and because there is price variation between the regions, that is, the price that's paid, the premium on fluid milk, varies from region to region, it becomes critical to have some way of determining who is and who is not part of the pool. And so, again, that authority to do so under the statute and pursuant to the regulations has not been contested by the plaintiffs. Again, they haven't contested the need for these standards, the authority to do so, and moreover, they haven't made any dispute about what the prior diversion limits were, that those were somehow inappropriate or improper. In fact, they have gone so far as to defend the prior standard. So really this does boil down to the reasonableness of the Secretary, the USDA's determination that a 10 percentage point modification was necessary in order to effectuate the objectives of the AMAA. And this notion that was presented by counsel that this was in some way a departure from earlier standards or factors is completely contrary to the record and, in a sense, contrary to counsel's own presentation. The idea of what is or is not a legitimate milk supply, the competitive milk shed, so to speak, of a particular geographic region simply reflects the various factors that counsel enumerated, that is supply, demand, and critically the willingness, readiness, and ability of various milk supplies to reach the Class 1 fluid milk market of the Mideast. So these factors are well established. These are the factors that undergirded the determination that was made here. And the fact that the rule simply articulates this in terms of explaining that as an end result, the problem here was that when you put everything together, there was excessive milk being pooled under the Mideast market in the sense that it was not reflective of the real needs and suppliers of the region. This really isn't a departure in any sense. As Your Honors noted, diversion limits really are nothing new. The USDA has always relied on them as a way of determining and achieving the objectives of the AMAA. It was noted by the Supreme Court in 1962 in Lehigh that provisions to establish performance standards aimed at ensuring that plants, handlers continue to provide fluid milk to marketing areas even in periods of short supply. That was noted in footnote 4 of Lehigh. In County Line, this court cited regulations from the 1960s. Now, County Line is a case that dealt with supply plant standards being revised. And it's very similar to the revision to the diversion limits that are at issue in this case, because, again, it had to do with ensuring that adequate milk supplies were going to Class 1 uses. And this court, of course, upheld the regulations at issue and noted that since the 1960s, there had been concerns about casual or incidental associations, token shipments, that there was this need to determine who is and who is not legitimately part of a given regional order.
But the question appears to be how you determine that.
Absolutely, absolutely. And here, the determination was made after 4 days' worth of hearings at which there were 25 witnesses and nearly 40 exhibits, et cetera, et cetera.
Did you use an inappropriate criterion when you looked at the end use of the milk?
No, the criteria here, Your Honor, was simply whether or not the diversion limits were so lax as to be undermining the objectives of the milk marketing order and of the Act. The goal, of course, in all of this, again, is to, for the USDA, is to try to optimize the incentives to fairly distribute the benefits and the burdens of serving the region. And as the record reflects, the provisions of fluid milk are more burdensome than other classes of milk. Milk is costlier to transport. That's the primary consideration. And in order to be able to ultimately ensure a stable market with a ready reserve of fluid milk, this was just another step in the ongoing process for the USDA of making these adjustments. The plaintiffs have acknowledged that previously the Department of the USDA has made adjustments to the standard. They cite in their brief prior regulations that made the diversion limits more strict at times, relaxed them at other times, and all of that reflects the fact that the factors at play are, you know, what are the market conditions, what does supply look like, demand, what is, who is a legitimate player in a given milk marketing order. So they have acknowledged these prior instances of adjusting, including tightening, strengthening diversion limits.
Let me just break it down and ask you, I think, a fairly simple question just to see how it would play out. If a dairy farmer wants to sell all of his milk for the blend price, he would need to sell it to the pool plant, right?
Not all of it, Your Honor. So something that's important to keep in mind here is this requirement, again, it's just a 10% adjustment. It doesn't, at no point has there ever been a requirement that 100% of a handler's receipts of milk received goes to pool plants. So before
what would be the incentive for the farmer to sell his, what's the incentive? Wouldn't the farmer want to sell to a non-pool plant?
No, Your Honor. The incentive, step back and maybe take the longer view as a response. So I apologize if it doesn't seem immediately like I'm being responsive. This whole milk marketing regime came into being in the 1930s because there was, as this court has previously noted, competition for fluid milk because of the higher prices that are paid for fluid milk. And that competition was drawing competitors from far away into the cities, and there was disorder in the market that led, under the AMA, real concern about the supplies in the market, the stability of the market. And so a regime was created in which there is sought more equitable distribution of the premiums on fluid milk. And it is important to keep in mind that the creation of that regime fundamentally changed the incentives. So in a sense, you are correct that for dairy farmers and handlers who are further from the cities where there is a higher demand for fluid milk, they have an incentive, just as Your Honor pointed out, to want to send milk to non-pool plants, local cheese plants, for example, that may be non-pool plants, because it's less expensive for them to do so. And so that is, in a sense, precisely, it's not that there's no incentive for pool participation. Obviously, pool participation offers the important advantage of affording the blend price. But Your Honor is correct if what you are getting at is that the incentives are aligned such that the goal of the producers and handlers is to qualify for the pool price, the advantageous pool price, while supplying the minimum requirement. So for people who are further away, say in the upper Midwest in Wisconsin, who want to take advantage of the fact that the Mideast milk marketing order pays a higher premium. I mean, this is fundamentally what this case goes back to, are different incentives and how those incentives have changed over time, and the USDA trying to continually make adjustments to ensure that the incentives are, to the extent possible, encouraging an orderly market. And so here, one of the key factors is that the fluid milk garners a higher premium in the Mideast, and there's a higher rate of consumption of fluid milk than in the upper Midwest. And so those things combined are inputs into the calculation of the blend price. And as a result, you see that the Mideast has an attractive blend price. And that's what's encouraging people to want, from the upper Midwest, for example, to want to gain entry to that market. But understandably, they want to do so at a minimum cost. And so they don't want to have to actually ship much fluid milk, which is costly to transport, into the Mideast. So these diversion limits allow them to participate in the Mideast milk marketing order, provided that they send, you know, the minimum amount required. It sets a threshold for participation, what it means to be a part of the Mideast milk marketing order. And so all that happened here is that prior to this rulemaking, for part of the year, basically the fall and winter, you could divert 70% of your milk outside of the Mideast, and provided that 30% was coming into the Mideast milk marketing order, all of that milk would qualify for the Mideast attractive blend price. And during the fall and that was during the summer and let me restate. So 70% diversion being allowed and 30% having to come in was during the spring and summer. And during the fall and winter, the rate was 60%. So 60% could go outside and 40% had to come into the Mideast milk marketing orders pool plants. So essentially, you were having to send 30 to 40% of milk to pool plants. And the new rule just adjusts those numbers. So now during the fall and winter, you can divert up to 50% of your milk instead of 60, and during the spring summer, you can divert 60% rather than 70. But it remains the case that you're still...
Each time those numbers change, there is a... go through the same process again?
This is really an interesting point and one worth noting. It is the case that the USDA does go through formal rulemaking. It went through formal rulemaking here in order to effectuate this change, but they didn't have to. As the plaintiffs point out, under the regulations that have not been challenged, it's 1033.13D7, I believe, the administrator, the market administrator, is actually authorized to make adjustments to the diversion limit without going through formal rulemaking. So this could have been achieved through a non-formal rulemaking mechanism, but here the USDA, as it typically does, goes through the hearing process whenever there's any kind of contest in the issues. I guess to make sure that I've addressed Your Honor's point, yes, there is under the current system a strong incentive for parties to try to gain access to the Mideast milk marketing order without sending milk to pool plants. And the diversion limit basically sets what that minimum you're going to have to send is to qualify for the blend price. And all that happened in this case is that the USDA recognized that that minimum wasn't set at the right point and needed to be adjusted. And the reason that that was necessary was because the evidence showed that they weren't achieving what they set out to do, which is to share equitably among the competitive milk shed, right? They were attracting all of these additional players who were really just entering at that minimum required level, but who would otherwise not be sending milk into this market. And as a result, jeopardizing the blend price and relatedly the adequacy of the supply of milk in the order, in the region.
Let me ask you another question about this RFA certification.
Yes,
do you think that a certification, that a regulation impacts, because this was the finding, both small and large businesses alike, is the same as a certification that the regulation does not impact small businesses? It seems to me that that's two distinct
That's correct.
Statement.
I think that's correct, Your Honor. The government, in presenting this case, doesn't take the view that those are the same. To be quite frank, if I had to take a view as to why that statement about the disparate impact was included in the regulation, I would say that it's because the RFA, when you read RFA case law and when you look at the legislative history, et cetera, there's a lot of discussion of disparate impact and concerns about economies of scale and efficiencies of scale and how regulations will impact small businesses. And I think that here the USDA, which of course is not charged with any special implementation of the RFA, they're not accorded any deference in terms of their interpretation of the RFA. They were simply trying to cover their bases and wanted to make clear that this was not in any sense non-uniform. But there's an earlier statement in the rule just prior to where they discuss disparate impact or lack thereof, where they talk about the fact that the rule doesn't revise established criteria for pooling eligibility. And, you know, looking at other cases such as Southwestern Pennsylvania Growth Alliance v. Brown or in the Third Circuit, this is the kind of statement that would be a factual basis in the government's view for certification. But as you noted earlier, Your Honor, I don't think that we reach that. These are interesting questions to pose perhaps, but here it's simply that the case that the RFA was not designed to protect, and as this court noted in Lamers, doesn't regulate producers. And so they simply are, they're not the ones subject to the regulations. All of the diversion limit here is based on a percentage of handlers' receipts. The various record-keeping and facilities requirements of the AMAA, of the regulations under the AMAA, the reporting requirements, of course, the responsibility to make payments, these are all regulations placed upon handlers.
And I understand that you're saying the regulations don't regulate the producers. That's your position.
That is our position.
But isn't that inconsistent with your argument that your power to amend the diversion limits comes from your power to determine what constitutes producer milk?
Well, producer milk is not the same as producer. Producer milk is a term of art or a regulatory term defined in the regulations. And producer milk doesn't mean, you know, It actually means what milk is part of the pool. And so it's not the same question. The diversion limit, if you look at the regulatory language, is very specific that it's a percentage of the handler's receipts. And so it's certainly the case that this has implications for the producers, indirect implications. We don't contend otherwise, and that's, in fact, why they have standing here to bring the claim with regards to the AMAA under the APA. But that the effect of the diversion limit in terms of determining what is producer milk is a determination of what percentage of a handler's receipts need to go to pool plants in order for all of the handler's milk to be deemed producer milk, which is to say milk that falls within the ambit of the pool, milk that's qualified for the blend price. I do just want to make sure that I've adequately addressed the court's any of the court's concerns with regard to the basis on which the 10% change was made. Certainly there was ample testimony presented and evidence presented. Indeed, the market administrator data showed that the diversion limits at their old levels were having an economic effect on producers, and the plaintiffs' appellants don't contest that. In fact, during the hearing, their expert witnesses agreed that there was, you know, that they didn't contest this 2% effect. They simply posited that it was having a significant economic effect or would have a significant economic effect on them if this change went into play. But, of course, the whole notion here is that they're not entitled to pool participation, and so that money that they claim as a loss is simply money they're not entitled to legitimately because they haven't met the minimum threshold for pool participation. I see that I'm out of time, so I will, if there are no further questions, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Shankles. Now for Mr. English.
Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Charles English, and I represent Dean Foods Company, which is a pure handler, and that is important for the discussion of the Regulatory Flexibility Act that I'm going to focus on. It's important because in the plain English that we might get to here, dairy farmers produce milk, but it is handlers and only handlers who can receive milk or divert milk. And the contested rule here is about milk that is diverted. In answer to your question, Your Honor, the issue about producer milk is an issue of who has control over pooling the milk. A producer literally has no control on the regulations of who pools the milk, except to not sell to a handler who won't pool it, and by going to a handler who will agree to pool it. But only a handler can divert milk, whether it's 60%, 50%, or 70%. And that is terribly important under Regulatory Flexibility Act, because as Lamer's Dairy indicates, handlers are regulated, producers are not.
What about dairy farmers that have on-site cheese manufacturing process?
Farmers can be both farmers and handlers. But then the claim would be as a handler, not as a farmer. And as Alto Dairy tells us, and lots of other dairy cases tell us, you've got to parse that very carefully as to whether there is standing as a handler. These plaintiffs have expressly in the complaint and in the briefs here brought a claim solely as producers. They have not brought a claim as handlers, and I think there would be an exhaustion of remedies issue if they did, but they didn't bring that claim. They have only brought it as farmers. But as farmers, they are not regulated. I respectfully disagree with counsel for the appellants. The standard, indeed, is something greatly different from adversely affected. That is not the standard. This is indeed a case of first impression for the Seventh Circuit, but it has been dealt with in the D.C. Circuit since the Regulatory Flexibility Act went into effect. And the first case that dealt with it, the Midtex case, in 1985, was a case in which customers of the regulated entities sued because they were adversely affected by electric rates. And Judge Bork, in going through a detailed analysis, and in particular going through 5 U.S.C. 603B, found as a matter of law that the interpretation had to be that small entities will be subject to the requirement. It's not subject to blank, it's subject to the requirement. Judge Rogers, further in Motor and Equipment Manufacturers, took that up and pointed out there's no obligation, in this case by USDA, to conduct a small entity impact analysis of effects on entities which it does not regulate. That is where the D.C. Circuit has come down, and we think that the D.C. Circuit deserves some respect here because of the number of cases that it has on this issue. But I go a step further. Congress has amended the RFA. They did so in the late 1990s. They made very significant changes. But one change they didn't make was to deal with Judge Bork's analysis, which has come through American Trucking and through Cement Kiln. We believe this case is much more like Cement Kiln. In Cement Kiln, hazardous waste combustors were subject to the regulation. Don't like to make the analysis because Dean Food sells milk, but for a moment assume that Dean is like the hazardous waste combustor. The people who brought the RFA claim, Continental Cement, as an intervener in that case, were generators of hazardous waste, and it was affected by the rules on emissions. And the D.C. Circuit held again, no, those people are not subject to the requirements of the rule. What is the rule here? The rule here is what handlers may divert or not divert. Nothing else. And so we think that the fact that Congress was silent after Judge Bork's analysis and further cases is terribly important. The cases go on and on. There's motor equipment. There's American trucking. Uniformly, that is the standard. Ironically, in aeronautical research, I think aeronautical research got it right under the D.C. Circuit standard. I don't think it's a modification of the standard. I don't think it is a revision. In aeronautical research, employees of subcontractors were required to submit to drug testing for air safety. And the agency initially did an analysis, then said, oh, we don't have to do an analysis. It wasn't entitled to deference, and it lost. But the employees who sued and the contractors who sued were indeed subject to the drug testing rule. Why shouldn't the RFA apply there as opposed to here? Dairy farmers have no ability, absent a handler, to pool milk. I see my time has expired.
Well, let me just ask you this. So then your bottom line, you know, what's your bottom line or your proposed standard for determining which entities can challenge an agency's RFA certification?
As the D.C. Circuit has stated, directly regulated. Mm-hmm. That is the term used by the D.C. Circuit. Mm-hmm. And producer dairy farmers are not directly regulated on this particular rule. I'm not saying there aren't other rules. For instance, if USDA suddenly announced that to be producer milk, you had to be grade A+, you had to be some new form of milk, that would be different. But this is a specific handler rule, and only handlers may divert milk. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. English. We'll hear now from Mr. Bisher.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Marvin Bisher, and I'm representing the Dairy Producer Cooperatives, Michigan Milk Producers Association, Land O'Lakes, National Farmers Organization, Dairy League Cooperative, and the Dairy Farmers of America, who were the proponents of the rules that are at issue here and who requested that the Secretary of Agriculture hold this hearing. We together represent a majority or a little better of the producers in the Mideast milk market. And just as in the Alto case, to which this is a sequel, in the period post 2000, when there were major changes in the orders, there were things in the orders that weren't working the way they needed to work, and we called this to the attention of the Secretary. He held hearings in this order. This was the second round of hearings in this order, and in other orders to bring the orders into line with marketing conditions in the area. And that's what this hearing did when it changed the diversion limitations and when it made certain other adjustments to the pooling arrangements of the hearing. I'd like to address the statutory issues which the appellants have raised here, and there are two as I would look at them. First of all, did this violate the statutory mandate in C5A of uniformity among dairy farmers? And the answer is clearly no. The issue is a non-starter because that statutory language applies to how the pool is distributed. And the Blair v. Zuber case, or Blair v. Freeman, Zuber v. Allen cases, which they cited, clearly apply to how the pool is distributed. It must be distributed uniformly except subject to allowable adjustments. That's just not an issue here. We're not talking about how the pool is distributed. We're talking about how the pool is defined. And the definition of a pool, as this court in County Line showed, requires certain performance requirements, which are supply plant shipping requirements or diversion limitations on plants. And you can't have a pool unless you say what it is. And that's what this is all about. These are provisions that are authorized by the statute under Section C7D because they are necessary to effectuate the scheme, necessary to effectuate the program. That's what diversion limits are. And really their challenge to diversion limits as being not authorized by the Act is an afterthought because they supported diversion limits at the hearing. That is the appellants. They supported the status quo of diversion limits. Now, their second challenge, so that's the challenge to the legality per se. The second challenge is that there's somehow an alleged unexplained departure from the standards that had been set up for establishing these procedures over the years, 30 years, 25 years, it's been stated differently. But I would suggest very respectfully, Your Honors, that, you know, there is no such 30-year policy that has been deviated from here. And in fact, It's mostly a product of, you know, of the oratory you've heard this morning. When you look at the cases, look at what's cited by counsel, and we looked at it. We looked at a 93 case, which was a 93 decision by the Secretary of Agriculture, which was the only decision cited in the body of their brief in chief that they said was deviated from here. And I analyzed it in my brief. That 93 decision tightened some diversion limits, loosened others in the same marketing area. It looked at, you know, what are the marketing conditions? What was the testimony there? It tightened and it loosened. It applied, you know, the very same type of analysis and standards here. What the Secretary had before it in the Alto case hearing and in this hearing was a situation where there was excessive milk being paper pooled, as was discussed by Judge Posner and Alto, and otherwise made a part of this pool without performing at a minimum level, which was required by the 40% Class 1 utilization in this market. And I just cite to you, you know, one exhibit, Exhibit 7, Request 3, which is data put in by the market administrator. It showed that the milk that was in Illinois, Iowa, Minnesota, and Wisconsin was only delivering to pool plants, serving the market, from 4 to 13% in the months of August through November of 2004. And he looked at this and said the producers who were supplying to the more expensive pool plants, which were the producers I'm representing, said, this isn't fair. It's not enough. You need to bring this up a little. So it was brought up a little bit with the diversions being the diversion limit being reduced. And that's the essence of what was done. No different than was done in 93 in one of the orders when diversions were tightened. No different than was done in six different decisions between 2000 and the present time, which were cited on page 31 of our brief. No different than was done in the first Alto case that your honors heard here. It was reasoned. It was fully on the basis of a detailed record, 1,150 pages of 4 days of testimony. This is adjudicatory-type proceedings. White Eagle participated, examined, cross-examined, testified. It was a full record, and it was detailed findings that were made and published in the Federal Record decision and fully in accordance with the law. And we urge you to affirm the district court. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beshear. How much time does Mr. Ventney have? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to refocus here, if I would, on what counsel for USDA and Mr. Beshear has referred to as detailed findings and consistency with past policy. And I'm looking at the final decision of January 23, 2006. Read the paragraph that makes the findings that are relevant just to this one part. This decision finds that permanent changes are necessary in the standards of the amount of milk that can be diverted from pool plants to non-pool plants to ensure that milk pooled is part of the legitimate reserve supply of Class 1 handlers. The hearing record clearly reveals that large volumes of milk not part of the legitimate reserve supply are being pooled, can be reported as diverted milk by the pooling handler and receive the order's blend price. The decision then goes on into the emergency prospect and finds that record evidence established that pooling standards were inadequate, resulting in erosion of the blend price by producers who were serving the Class 1 needs of the market and needed to be changed on an emergency basis. Your Honor, again, we're looking at words that describe, not words that find, not words that establish criteria. Notwithstanding Attorney Heifetz's reference to the record, it is not the record that we look at to determine if USDA has complied with the Administrative Procedure Act with consideration of historical factors and with consideration of statutory factors. It is the decision itself, and this is the decision itself. There was, in fact, in this record, in this decision, I mean, there was in this decision no reference to ready, willing, and able as a standard by which producers are pooled with diverted milk. Attorney Heifetz suggests otherwise. Read the decision carefully. There is nothing there with respect to any of these pooling provisions, ready, willing, and able. Attorney Heifetz suggests that ho-hum, this is nothing different than in the past, supply and demand. Well, in fact, in this record, supply was increasing, demand for Class 1 was reducing. In every case where that has been a factor in past decisions, diversion provisions have been loosened to accommodate that extra supply. This decision, I believe, didn't address those factors because the agency couldn't. In fact, the last page of Exhibit 11 in the hearing transcript, the secretary, the market administrator, was asked, has there been any problem? Has anybody complained to you of a problem of inadequate milk supplies? Has anybody asked for a temporary adjustment? The answer in both cases was no. The secretary did not and could not, but most importantly, did not make a finding of adequacy or inadequacy of supply relating to diversions, as he has in every other case in which diversions were modified, including the 1993 decision that was referred to in part of the brief, the 1997 decision in the upper Midwest, where it said we must accommodate all the milk or we will have disorder. This decision, which excluded milk for some excess reserve reason, unrelated in the body of the decision to supply and demand, unrelated to the fact that handlers were getting enough milk. Where is the potential inadequacy of supply in this decision to which Attorney Heifetz refers? It is not there. I want to refer briefly to Mr. English's argument. Again, we have a situation in which some portion of significant rules would never be reviewed or would never be subject to an RFA because handlers, of course, like Mr. English's clients, do not have standing to challenge the distribution of money. That is what this case is about. There have been challenges to milk orders by those indirectly affected, consumers, for example, store operators. And courts have said that such as the community nutrition, those do not have standing. But the reason that producers are subject to, or the analysis of producers being subject to these rules in the revenue distribution, is identical for RFA analysis as it was for standing analysis in Stark versus Wickard, which is also discussed in the predecessor Alto case. That is, producers are affected by the distribution of money. Mr. Bayshore says, oh, there are limits in how the pie may be distributed for reasons of use. In other words, you can't really take money away from one producer in the pool and give it to somebody else. That was the essence of the Lehigh case. That was the essence of other cases. But, Your Honor, the Secretary may reduce the pie and exclude some producers altogether. Now, does that make sense that you can't take a little bit of money from a producer and give it to another producer, but you can take all of the money from a producer, kick them out of the pool entirely, and give it to another producer, and that is unreviewable? That's not covered by all milk, all producers, to all handlers in Section 608C5B, not 5A as referred to. I suggest not. Your Honor, my red light's on. I reaffirm all of the points covered in the brief, and I wish I had more time to discuss them and exchange in dialogue, but I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Bettany. Indeed, the Court thanks all counsel in the case for their very fine briefs and their very fine oral arguments today. And the case will be taken under advisement.